63. Now, your host for Public Pulse, Floyd Whitey.
Good morning and welcome to Public Pulse. This morning, I am joined by Sheridan Memorial Hospital Doctor of Internal and Addiction Medicine, Jason Ackerman. Good morning, Doc, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for letting me come back.
I love having you on here. You and I touched on issues that I've had with alcoholism just a little bit the last time you were here. We will be addressing a lot of that today. But before we get into this, how's your fall season going?
It's great. Certainly we are seeing kind of an uptick in people just having a little bit more problems. And I think that does seem to there's always a seasonal component to the addiction. Fall comes, winter comes, days get dark, things get colder. It just seems like we see a little bit more.
So there is a correlation to the patients that you see depending upon a season, or would you say that?
I think there is, and I think some of it is just that addiction issues are always tied so closely to mental health and behavioral health, and I think holidays can be really, really great for a lot of people, but it can also be a really big struggle, and so I think as that struggle increases, certainly the addiction problems also increase.
I'll admit, you know, when I was drinking, there were certain holidays where I locked the door and got a bottle and sat down by myself. And that's how I spent my day,
right,
unfortunately. But I'm sure it's not all you deal with. But why study and practice addiction medicine? What got you into this field?
So while I was doing my internal medicine residency, some of the attending doctors that I worked with, I think you always find that person in life that you want to be like them. They're your role models. And they worked really heavily with addiction. And so as I started doing more and more of that in my practice here, I kind of realized just the rewards that go with it. I love internal medicine and I love the disease prevention and the study of everything and trying to solve the problems. But at some point when you're treating numbers, cholesterol numbers, blood pressure numbers, you feel like you're just treating numbers. But when you make a difference in addiction, you can see these people in their 20s, 30s, 40s go from homeless to all of a sudden they're getting their house back and their families back. And it just feels like you're really helping people get back in their entire life. And it's just really rewarding.
Absolutely. And I've seen that story a couple times. I'm lucky enough to see that story a couple times. I've seen it go the other way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you have as well. And before we get really onto it, let's address the basics. What is addiction?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And really what it comes down to is just loss of control. So certainly there's physical components of addiction, especially when we talk about substance use, alcohol or opiates or stimulants. And at some point, the body just doesn't respond the same if the body doesn't have those substances involved. And certainly with alcohol, you know, when you get to that addictive dependency point, if you don't have alcohol, you go through withdrawals. And many times people are only drinking in order to function. They're not drinking to have fun anymore. They're drinking just so that they don't go through those withdrawals. And then there are the behavioral parts of it. People continue to use it even though they're suffering big consequences, and that can be loss of job, loss of family members, drinking despite health consequences and ending up in the hospital or the emergency department over and over. And really, I think the hallmark of addiction, though, is just that complete loss of control, like not being able to stop when you want to stop or having it go on way longer than you want it to go on.
You know, there's certain misconceptions, I guess you can say, or perceptions that are out there. I carried at one time two flasks, one for vodka, and only vodka was allowed in that flask, and then one for whatever whiskey I was drinking at the time. And to me, I was of age. There was nothing illegal or wrong about what I was doing. Being able to produce a flask wherever, whenever, you know, it's that image, you know. Mm-hmm. It's almost, unfortunately, romantic.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and me I wanted to be the writer of the next great American novel. And unfortunately, a lot of those creative minds had lost themselves in alcohol, which, you know, unfortunately led to a lot of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that romantic image of the suffering writer, you know, right. And I'm not saying that's what led me to my personal alcoholism, but for sure, that idea of that alcohol, it's legal, it's romantic, I don't have to worry about this.
Right.
Do you see that often?
We see that all the time. And I think that's really a great way to describe it, because we see a ton of people, even after they have stopped drinking or are trying to stop drinking, they can look at just all of the destruction that alcohol has caused around them, whether it's, you know, just to their own body or their social life or professional life, but they can still romanticize that feeling of that, you know, that first intoxication, that first drunk. And that's kind of what everybody is always chasing. And somehow the mind holds on to that positive image way stronger than it does to all of the negative consequences of alcohol.
And that's crazy. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we hear that all the time, you know, oh, you're chasing that first experience. You're chasing that. And I used to think it was kind of, you know, just something that people said, but it's really what we're doing. What is it about that? Have we found anything as to why we hang on to that positive aspect of the experience?
So we know just genetically, some people are going to be more prone to addictions. And so we, as we've studied this just over the last 5-10 years, we've realized that genetics make up about 60% of somebody's risk factor. So over half of the risk of becoming addicted to any sort of substance, and even extending that out to gambling, is about over half of that is genetic. There's a ton of other things that go into it too, mental health. And so various diagnoses, whether it's anxiety or depression or more extreme bipolars or schizophrenias, like that plays a huge role in this. But there's been some really interesting studies done recently in mice with amphetamines, and it's the brain actually makes different memories when people are intoxicated on stimulants. And we kind of assume the same about some opiates and alcohol, that it's a slightly less stable memory, but it encourages those positive recollections. And so it's a really interesting pathway with a protein called actin. And at someday in the future, that might be one of the targets that we use for treatment. But right now we do know that it's kind of different memories that are formed.
That's fascinating. The chemistry in the brain obviously has been changed.
Right.
And the way that memory is formed is altered.
Yeah.
And so it's literally the rosy colored glasses, right?
Yeah, 100%.
That is fascinating. We can actually somewhat gauge that as
yes.
of right now. When, and I know I'm getting off on a side tangent here, but with the gambling, is that more of like a dopamine addiction? Can we become, excuse me, addicted to our own dopamine?
We can. And that's been one of the fascinating trends in understanding addiction over these, you know, last, again, 10 years, 15 years, is we now know that this is not just somebody making bad choices. Like, there is truly a biologic disease component to this. And so, you know, we can stick people in very fancy SPECT scanners and with certain dyes, and we can point to exactly which part of the brain is going to light up at various stages in the addiction.
Wow.
And interestingly, gambling follows that exact same pattern. And so even though we don't necessarily have opiates hitting the opiate receptor or alcohol, you know, hitting every receptor in the brain, you don't have a substance doing that, but those same parts of the brain light up and you still get that dopamine rush, and you still have, you know, those same brainstem areas being activated when people are going through gambling withdrawal, which turns out is a real thing.
Wow. And again, you know, the misconception that this, oh, well, that's a choice that he's making mm-hmm. to go and do that. The brain is literally guiding that individual to do that.
It is. And the really fascinating part about that is when people are going through withdrawal or starting to have those cravings, the part of the brain that's lighting up is the brainstem part. And so the brainstem is really, that's the make your heart beat, make your lungs breathe. You know, if there's kind of that rustling in the bushes in the dark, you get the fight or flight response. So that withdrawal is really tied to the survival part of the brain. And so it is literally your brain saying, you need this substance. you need to do this or you will die. So it takes a lot to overcome that.
So we've actually essentially found the need for this is primal.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Once you cross that line into addiction, it truly is a primal response in the brain.
That is incredible. And I think it's really beneficial for those people out there to realize that, yes, you have control. You have to seize control back, but your brain is working against you right now. And,
yes.
And so to fail, we can fail and still return once again, which I've seen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I failed multiple times.
Yeah.
I told myself I was going to quit drinking. This is it. This is the last rock bottom I'm going through, only to fail 6 months later. And to know that, well, it wasn't always this willing choice. My brain literally guided me to that, where it's like, you are feeling this, and I'm not making excuses. Mm-hmm. It's just something that we have actually discovered.
Right. And I think when I talk with a lot of patients, it can be very helpful in just validating, you know, they have tried. It's not that they're wanting to continue drinking. This is truly a battle. And I think now that we understand it as a disease process, the great part about that is we also have treatments that can target that. And so while the patient themselves has to be the one to take the responsibility, you know, I always joke with patients, like, I've got a lot of meds that can help tip the odds in your favor, but I don't have one that's going to knock the bottle out of your hand. Like,
yeah,
it really does have to start with the patient. But understanding that disease process gives us a lot of options for treatment.
And we see that a lot in nicotine addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we got this new pill. It's going to get rid of the cravings. We've got this patch that'll help get rid of the cravings.
Right.
And once those cravings are gone, the battle is much easier to win.
Right. But it's still a battle. It's
yes.
still hard. And people definitely have to put in the work. But yeah, it tips the odds so much more in the patient's favor.
Now, what is the difference between drug addiction and drug abuse? Is there one?
There is. And I think it's an important distinction. And abuse purely means that we're using things in probably not a very safe manner. And so, again, genetics end up playing a big role in that. You know, there's people that can go to a party and take a few pills and walk away and not really think about it again. Or there's people that can go and maybe overdo it a little bit at the bar or have a few more drinks and not really think about it anymore. And so we know that those things are putting their health at risk. They are putting possibly social connections at risk, but they're not necessarily causing that dependence problem. So true addiction is where, again, your brain and body just don't function without that. And so once you've got to that point where you can't function without it, you're losing control of it, and that's the true addiction. And so we look at everything kind of on a spectrum. You know, there's unsafe alcohol use where you might have one or two more drinks than the American College of Physicians would recommend, but not necessarily going to have big consequences. There's alcohol abuse where maybe you're really going for it and the binge drinking, you know, you go out one night and have six or eight drinks too many, and that's a real problem, but you're not necessarily to the addicted point. And then you get all the way to that, you know, the other end of the spectrum where you truly are needing it to function. And even within the realm of addiction, there's that huge gap. There's people that are very addicted to alcohol and maybe drinking five or six drinks a day. On the other hand, you have people that are needing to go through a fifth a day or more, which is 16 to 18 drinks a day. And so there's just everything exists on a spectrum. And I think that's kind of the important takeaway is it's never too early to intervene on that.
And I'm glad that you brought up the binge drinking, because I would say that is probably one thing that led ultimately to my addiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because it's not every day, right?
Right.
That's what I tell it. Well, it's not every day. Yes, when I go out, it's far too much,
mm-hmm.
but I've got control of this because it's not every day. And so you make these excuses. I had a great sponsor who used to tell me all the time, I can find 10,000 reasons to take a drink from here to the door.
Right.
You know, and I've got 10,000 more excuses as to why I need to do that.
Yeah.
And it's started with this abuse mm-hmm. of the substance in the first place. But again, perception, I wasn't abusing it. I was just going out having fun with my college buddies or my army buddies, and that's just the way it is.
Right.
Next thing I knew, I was drinking every day.
Right.
And but again, a process. And we're gonna talk a little bit more about this. I got to take a quick commercial break. We'll continue with Sheridan Memorial Hospital Doctor of Internal and Addiction Medicine, Jason Ackerman, right after this. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM. Sheridan.
First Federal Bank and Trust would like to recognize this week's winner of $1,000 and a $1,000 marketing donation match from Sheridan Media as part of their community commitment. Boy Scout Troop number 117 and Cub Scout Pack 385 receiving these funds for random drawing.
Could your organization be next? We're giving $1,000 to a qualified nonprofit organization every week. Visit our website, efirstfederal.bank, for details. First Federal Bank and Trust and Sheridan Media present Community Commitment. Member FDIC.
Delicious McDonald's deals are now more fun, more accessible, and better than ever through the McDonald's mobile app. Download the McDonald's app, join My McDonald's Rewards to get your free large fries with a $1 minimum purchase. Plus, when you join My McDonald's Rewards, you start earning points on every eligible order. Points you can put towards more free food. Just order, relax, and enjoy. Go to the Google Play or Apple App Store, download the McDonald's mobile app, and start saving. Download it now.
Just in time for your holiday dinners, the Health Nut announces that they have organic and natural turkeys, Beeler's spiral-cut hams, gluten-free and regular stuffing, fresh organic cranberries, organic yams and potatoes, gluten-free and regular gravy, gluten-free and regular dinner rolls, gluten-free and regular homemade pies, dairy-free and regular whipped topping. Order your Thanksgiving pies early. Pick them up to ensure they are fresh. The Health Nut, for healthy holiday dinners.
This is Ken here at Prime Rate Motors, where we understand everybody's situation is different. We recently had a customer that needed to keep his ranch truck, not traded in. What he needed was a car for town. After visiting with him, we discovered that what he did have was an extra stock trailer. We were able to take that trailer in as a trade-in and got him a nice economy car that was good on gas and easy to park downtown. Stop in, let's work something out. Here at Prime Rate Motors, the Super Trailer Store, or PrimeRateMotors.com.
ERA Carroll Realty is back with the 7th Annual Holiday Shopping Sweepstakes.
Shop local first.
This is your chance to win $1,000 in gift certificates and chamber bucks from our Sheridan and Buffalo merchants. And we've tied into a national campaign to give you a chance at winning $15,000 cash.
Shop local first, all across the area. Shop here first.
Five winners will receive prizes totaling $1,000 to retailers like Susie Garber Johnson with D.A. Davidson, Landon's Greenhouse and Nursery, True Built Builders, Designing Dinners, Babe's Flowers, and Urban Thrift. Just go to the contest page at SheridanMedia.com. Enter once each day through December 12th.
Hi, this is Lisa Hansen with ERA Carroll Realty. We're about more than real estate. We're about family, friendship, and community. Happy holidays.
Shop local first. All across the area. Shop here first.
Good morning and welcome back to Public Pulse. I'm Floyd Whiting. My guest this morning is Doctor of Internal and Addiction Medicine at Sheridan Memorial Hospital, Dr. Jason Ackerman. Now, in the first part, we did discuss what addiction is and some of the misunderstandings that we all share about addiction. And for approximately 14 years, I regularly drank quite heavily. For a few of those years, yes, years, I drank daily. And in 2015, after hitting a true rock bottom, I quit. And it took a lot of therapy, a lot of counseling, and yes, some prescribed drugs to help me out of that hole. It was the most difficult thing I could probably say I've ever done in my life. Doctor, what is alcohol use disorder?
So again, alcohol use disorder kind of is a spectrum. And, you know, we like to be as precise as we can in our diagnoses. And so it ranges from mild to moderate to severe. But But essentially, it's how much is that substance or how much is alcohol impairing you? Are you having social consequences from it, life consequences, health consequences? Are you physically dependent where you just can't function without it? And how much of that is just kind of loss of control? Have you tried to quit, tried to stop, tried to cut back, and it just doesn't work for you? You actually have to have that next drink in order to make it through the night, make it through the day, make it to work. So again, it's a spectrum just depending on how severe the alcohol affects their lives.
I have a memory, more than one day, probably for at least a 6 month period. The drinking started at noon. It was two shots of vodka just to get me where I needed to be to get through the rest of the day until finally 6 p.m. Now we can really start drinking. And I know that seems absurd to many, but I know at the same time there's people out there listening right now who are doing the exact same thing. I need this to get through the day. How common is addiction? How commonly are you seeing this problem among the Sheridan population?
So addiction is shockingly common. And I think if we look at just alcohol use disorder, which is kind of mostly what we're talking about today, it's interesting because if you look across the country, you see a little over 10% of people have an alcohol use disorder. And so it doesn't necessarily matter age or race or sex. Like it's a fairly constant number, which means 1 in 10 people is struggling with alcohol use disorder in some way, shape, or form. And if you look nationally, the numbers are pretty staggering. There's over 29 million people last year in the United States alone that suffered from alcohol use disorder. Unfortunately, what we also see is people reaching out for treatment, for help is also extremely low. And so of those 29 million, only about 1.4 million people sought out help. So that's less than 5% of people actually get out and look for help. We've seen studies where people even can go into hospitals and have very clear alcohol-related problems, and only about 2% of those people are offered medications for help. And so part of that, I think, is just understanding addiction. We've come a long ways, and a lot of people aren't necessarily savvy to the fact that we can treat addiction. But I think there is just that huge shame component, unfortunately. And I think one of the big pushes in addiction medicine is to destigmatize this and be able to treat it like a disease. You know, if people were so ashamed that they wouldn't come to the doctor to help their heart disease or their diabetes, we would be in a terrible way. Now, unfortunately, alcohol has just tremendous consequences, and frequently people struggle with that shame component and just having a really hard time reaching out for help.
Especially if they're in a high profession job. This isn't helping my image, but at the same time, it would be worse if it got out that I went and received treatment, whether that be within the office or anything else. What is happening to us physiologically when we drink alcohol?
So alcohol is one of the more interesting substances, and not necessarily interesting in a good way, but it truly affects everything. So alcohol itself, we know it's metabolized through the liver, and so we can cause a lot of liver damage, both acutely and chronically. And so we think of people going into chronic liver failure as kind of traditionally what we think about.
But death of alcoholism.
Death of alcohol, yeah. Cirrhosis of the liver. But we also know it impacts the heart. You can have heart failure coming just purely from alcohol. It's directly toxic to the nerves, and so people have nerve problems and pain in their feet and hands and all sorts of neuropathy. From the brain perspective, alcohol is a little bit of a messy substance. So other substances can really target very specific receptors, and with that, we have really good targeted treatments and medications. They act very, in a very targeted manner. Alcohol really affects almost all of the neurotransmitters. And so, again, it can be directly toxic to the brain, to the nerves in the brain. It can impair memories. It can recreate a physiologic depression. And so people can have depression basically just from the alcohol. It can even cause an alcohol-induced bipolar syndrome. And so people can have a true bipolar syndrome just purely from the alcohol itself. So there really isn't much of the body that isn't touched by heavy alcohol use.
That's incredible. And you don't tend to think that alcohol is kind of the whole package,
right?
You know, when it comes to affecting the brain, you tend to think that other things are a lot more dangerous, and maybe they are specifically because they kill you faster. Mm-hmm. But to me, it sounds like alcohol would be a more drastic addiction than others, just because it sounds like a bigger hill to climb.
It really is. It really is. Just solely based on the number of neurotransmitters affected, like, it does get much more difficult to treat.
That's incredible. Now, is it just genetics that cause some people to become addicted to alcohol or abuse alcohol, feel the need to abuse alcohol more than others? You know, before the show, we talked about the example of the two lawyers going out having the exact same amount of drinks. One guy doesn't really mind. The other guy is strapped down to a table because he's throwing a fit.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call it an allergy because we had nothing else to call it.
Right.
Genetics?
Genetics are a huge component. So, yeah, so well over half the risk factor, we estimate about 60% of the risk factor is genetics. But there's a lot of other things that can go into it. Certainly various mental health and behavioral health conditions. So we see a lot of alcohol use in patients that have had traumatic events. And so PTSD can play a huge role in that. We see a lot of people with underlying anxiety, and alcohol tends to medicate that. And really, it makes people much more prone to that dependence if they're self-medicating their anxiety. And so I think that is always one of the hard parts about the mental health component of it is, you know, alcohol can cause all of these problems, but a lot of times people come in with these problems and to start drinking alcohol and self-medicate. And so it really is a chicken or the egg kind of question.
And when you see your patients, is there a practice or a policy that you have that asks them to seek mental health counseling?
So we always make that available. One of the things that I really always stress with patients is that there is no one right way to recovery, you know, and, you know, we have great counselors in the area, and mental health is a huge component of recovery. We have a really strong AA community in Sheridan, and that can be really, really beneficial. There's medications. And so some people need just one or the other. A lot of people need all of it. So I don't ever mandate that as part of recovery, but we kind of offer it as options so that each person, we can kind of figure out exactly what fits them and what they need from that. But I would say for most people, an underlying depression, anxiety, bipolar tends to be the rule rather than the exception in addiction. And, you know, we estimate anywhere between 60 and 80% of people with an addiction issue have an underlying mental health disorder. And I think one of the crucial things is really addressing that, because you can do everything to quit the substance, but unless we really root out that underlying cause and address that, recovery can be kind of short-lived.
I had a man tell me once that I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a thinking problem, and I had to address that. So when I started on my road to recovery, I threw my hat in every ring.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it takes is basically the thought process I went in there with.
Right.
Multiple counselors at the VA in Cheyenne. And up here, I had prescription drugs that helped me kind of ease those cravings that came along. Also helped with the PTSD that I was suffering from. And yes, I went to AA for quite some time. It was one of those things where I was willing to try just about anything out of desperation to keep that bottle out of my hand. But ultimately, it just comes down to making that choice first, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, we talked briefly offline. We talked about gabapentin. Is that something that you have prescribed in the past or not?
Yeah, frequently. And so gabapentin is a great medication. And so one of the interesting things about the study of alcohol addiction is, you know, we do have a lot of medications and a lot of targets that we can treat. And so there are three FDA-approved medications for alcohol use disorder. Gabapentin actually is not one of them. It's an off-label use, but it tends to be one of our gold standard medications. And really, it can kind of help people with cravings. It's been shown to reduce the amount of alcohol people drink, reduce the number of drinking days, increase the chance that people can completely eliminate alcohol. More than that, though, when people stop drinking, oftentimes there's a period of about a month or so, maybe a little bit more, where everything is just kind of terrible. And so we call it a protracted withdrawal syndrome. And depression is worse, anxiety is through the roof, sleeping is a problem. And gabapentin, based on the receptors it hits in the brain, can kind of smooth that process out for people. And if you can make it through that first month to 6 weeks, like that's really the highest time for returning to alcohol use. And so if we can help you through that period, that is absolutely beneficial. So, and then gabapentin, the nice part about that one is it has been shown to be safe for a long time. And so I have patients that are on it for that 6 weeks. I have patients that are on it for years. And so there's a lot of options there with medications.
And when it came to the gabapentin, my own personal experience, the VA allowed me to pretty much take as much as I want, and I didn't abuse it, and it was easy to get off of. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I noticed. I never missed gabapentin,
right?
The way that I missed alcohol, and I did have a lot of counseling as well. I mean, I had three separate counselors who were dealing with three separate things in my life, and I was constantly going in there. But I think that's what it really took to get me there.
Right. And it's interesting because so gabapentin is certainly a very helpful medication, and it is one that it's not commonly abused, but occasionally it can be abused. And so we have to go into it with a little bit of caution. But in general, there's a lot of things where we can look at it and just find like what is going to be the safer way to address this while we're allowing the rest of the recovery to kind of take hold. And whether, again, that's counseling or AA or family support. You know, there's a lot of different ways to approach that. And our medications are really there to kind of treat the underlying problem, bide time while you essentially reprogram your brain and reprogram that frontal lobe and thinking part of the brain.
And I would say that took me 2 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years. I isolated myself for quite some time and just kind of made that conscious decision. What kind of man do I want to be? Because I've got to reinvent who I am. I've got to put this one down. I got to create somebody else. The U.S. Army used to take us in and do evaluations. During those evaluations, we were asked how many drinks we had in a given week. Guys, I know it's wrong to do, but every time I lied, because I knew if I told the truth, I would spend the next 2 hours talking to the chaplain in the other office. We all tended to do that. Mm-hmm. And we joked around about it afterwards, mm-hmm, over drinks. My question is, what are the signs? Because I'm looking at this pad, clicking these yes or no's, mm-hmm, going, okay, well, yeah, I do that, but I'm not going to tell anybody.
Right.
Is there an evaluation that we can give ourselves where we're like, okay, I haven't crossed the line just yet.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it's interesting because there's a lot of different tools that we can use that have been validated in terms of just saying, is this person at risk? Do we need to look at this a little bit more? You know, one of the classic med school questions that we used to use, or questionnaires, was called the CAGE questionnaire. And so CAGE, and have you thought about cutting down on alcohol use? Are other people annoyed by your alcohol use? Have you felt guilty about how much you're drinking? And then E, have you ever had an eye opener? Meaning, have you ever had to drink at noon to get going, or for breakfast to get going? And if there's a positive answer to any one of those, it means that we should maybe dive into that a little bit more. There are other kind of better validated questions that we use. For example, that some of them look at number of drinks. Like for men, how many times in the last year have you had 5 drinks or more in a day? For women, how many times have you had 3 to 4 drinks or more in a day? And then starting looking at frequency of that. But really it all then comes down to when we're screening, how is it impacting your life? And I would say when I was doing just pure internal medicine and running an internal medicine clinic, there were a lot of times where really had suspicion or pretty much knew that somebody was using more alcohol than they should based on lab values or just certain answers or tendencies. Now running an addiction clinic, it's much easier because people don't generally come into my clinic unless they've fully admitting they have a problem.
They have taken an evaluation.
Right. And so they're, you know, people are much more proactive. And so I think to that extent, it's a little bit easier for me. But I think if somebody has ever wondered, am I overdoing this a little bit? That's probably a good indication that they are.
That's a great thought. If you're having to question yourself, then you probably are. Because if you feel it, I imagine someone around you feels mm-hmm. it. Doc, how do people get a hold of you?
So our clinic, we're very easy to contact. You can look at our website. For the hospital website, our information is on there. Our phone number is 675-2674. You can call. And we have a really amazing clinic. So our front desk person, Haley, is just amazing. But then our clinic is small. It's me and a physician's assistant, Casey McKenzie. We have a couple of certified addiction nurses, Shiloh and Katie. So if anybody just has a question, they can call and we can get you in for an appointment, can answer questions. Really, our clinic is all about kind of harm reduction and helping people. So if we can find ways to get you in and help, we'll do it.
Doc, I want to thank you so much for coming in this morning. It's always a pleasure being able to sit down and talk to you about these things. I'm already looking forward to our next show together.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Absolutely.